East. 4. The price of slippers.
Yama, I feel sick.
What's wrong, Saeed? What would make you feel better?
If I have some meat, then I'll feel a lot better.
My father tells the story in the present tense, as if no time has elapsed between his childhood and this moment in Calgary. Time is fluid when you live in the intermediate state of exile and memory. When her son said things like that, my grandmother would go out to the local store and buy some canned luncheon meat on credit. Young Saeed would wolf it down straight out of the can, closing his eyes in ecstasy. Sometimes he'd eat it so fast that he actually would feel sick. When he was a little older, he would occasionally get a treat so special that it came as a shock. The creamy sweetness of a ripe banana, or the rich, melting flavor of chocolate that lingers on your tongue. But that came even later. When I was 10, I won a reading competition at school and was rewarded with a voucher for a 3-pound bar of chocolate from World's Finest. Eager and anxious, I looked for my prize in the mail every day, but it never arrived. I complained about the unfairness of it all, and that was when my father told me that he was about 15 before he ever tasted chocolate. I still felt cheated, but not in the same way that he was. When my father's family arrived in Jordan, they were given tents and shown to land that had been set aside for refugees. In 1952, that informal settlement became known officially as Jabal el-Hussein. It was one of several refugee camps set up in Jordan in the wake of Al-Nakba by UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine refugees in the Near East. Until he was 6, my father's home was a tent where the family slept like tinned fish, huddled together for warmth, some kicking in their sleep or crying out or whimpering. Still hungry, Yaba, Yama. Whenever water leaked into the tent, someone would get up and try to find a sheet of plastic to pull over them, or else everyone would move, grumbling, to another part of the tent that seemed a little drier. As a young child, Saeed was carried around on his older brother's shoulders and tossed from one to the other like a football. There were disagreements and fights, as in any family, but they were together, especially at night. They spent 5 years in that tent before they were able to get a house. Finally, they had 4 walls and some protection from the elements, but not from hunger. This was a time when the family had meat only once a week, a small piece for each of them. Dinner was more likely to be some combination of cooked vegetables, rice, bread, olive oil with cheese, all sprinkled with za'atar, a mixture of oregano and other herbs and roasted sesame seeds. Often there wasn't enough, and many nights Saeed and his family went to sleep with empty stomachs. But we loved each other, my father told me. We all ate at the same time when we had food, and we never fought over it. As he grew older, Saeed began to assert himself. He was the only one of the children who was constantly getting into trouble, sparking the stories of how his brothers brought back the wrong baby, a bad, naughty baby, from under the Nakba tree. By the time my father was a teenager, the tents supplied by UNRWA, when the first refugees arrived after the Nakba, had given way to more permanent structures, mostly constructed by the refugees themselves, and with UNRWA contributing materials for roofing. Yet Jabal el-Hussein was still known as a refugee camp, and my father was deeply embarrassed when his better-off acquaintances found out where he lived. I have to cover up, he thought. I have to be someone I'm not, something better. Throughout my father's childhood, war was never far away. Saeed was aware of the activities of Palestinian resistance fighters, including the founding of Fatah and then of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, but he had other things to think about. Often he was more worried about his reputation than about the war zone in which he lived, so he would make sure that his friends picked him up somewhere else, away from the camp. He would make his way to a better neighborhood on foot and stand casually in front of some nice-looking building, waiting for them to show up, trying to protect an identity fabricated by shame.
As he could seldom afford a taxi for the return trip home, my father would walk back to the refugee camp along the dirt roads, often in the rain. Along the way, he would be splashed by passing vehicles as they tried to take shortcuts. Seeing his muddy clothes and shoes, Grandma Nima would yell, "Not again! We just did the washing!" He always had the same excuse. He'd been play fighting with his friends. She would click her tongue with frustration as he tracked mud across the floor. She tried hard to keep their simple home tidy, especially in case neighbors visited. One day he slipped and tore his only pair of pants. They could not be repaired, and his family had no money. He was forced to wear a pair of red pantaloons that belonged to one of his sisters for a week until my grandfather was able to find a little extra cash to buy him a used pair of men's trousers. Although he was a bit of a rebel, my dad was intelligent and determined. Education was the only hope for any kind of future. There was something pushing him not to be left behind. At 14, he was working at Al-Shakshir Pharmacy in downtown Amman, cleaning and helping the pharmacist. The owner noticed him and said, "You're smart. Why don't you study to become a pharmacy assistant?" My father enrolled at a local college in Amman and studied hard, earning his diploma in pharmacy at the age of 19. At the time in Amman, according to my father, there was no official college of pharmacy. His license to practice pharmacy hangs in my office till this day. He walked about 7 kilometers a day between school, work, and home. It was enough to put holes in shoes that were not durable to begin with, but he and his family learned to make sandals out of pieces of rubber cut from tires, bound together with string. His training at the college was intensive and demanding, but eventually Saeed became so skilled that he could manage the pharmacy himself without the supervision of the pharmacist. Grandma Nima would say things like, "I never knew that the youngest one, the troublemaker, would do so well. I guess we got the right baby after all." Saeed's achievements gave him a privileged position in his world. Although many of the people in the camp were accustomed to relying on folk remedies such as maramia tea or coffee infused with roasted cumin or bloodletting, still quite common tradition in Islamic culture, they started coming to him for help when they were sick or in need of medication. Many could not afford prescriptions or a consultation with a physician, but Saeed could get medicines for free or at cheaper rates through his work. My father never turned anyone away, and my grandfather Tuma was proud of him for that. "Here he is," people in the camp would say when they saw him. "Come in, come in. Drink some coffee." One day, a perfume company gave Saeed hundreds of samples to distribute to pharmacy customers. Instead, he took the samples to the refugee camp and handed them out to neighbors, friends, and family. He kept some of the samples for himself and poured them into a bucket so he could wash his feet in perfumed water. "I did this so I could feel, for a short time, that I was doing something I thought rich people would do," he told me. For weeks, the fragrance of perfume mingled with the heavy odors of the camp. My father remembered an earlier time, too, when another luxury arrived in the camp. "What is this sound? Where is it from?" People would gather, eager and curious. My dad and his brother, Faisal, had saved up to buy a radio, paying for it in installments. At night, we listened to the Cairo radio station, knowing that we could go to jail if we were found out. Egypt's socialist president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, was no friend of monarchies, or of religious people for that matter, and his growing popularity in the Arab world posed a threat to Jordan's King Hussein, who was frequently criticized on Voice of the Arabs. The Cairo-based station broadcast throughout much of the Arab world, spreading Nasser's calls for Arabic unity in the face of imperialism and messages of support for the liberation of Palestine. "We took a few risks," Dad said in his understated manner, "and it helped the boredom to hear those distant voices. A few risks, their curiosity could easily have landed them in prison." Jabal al-Hussein was one of 4 refugee camps in Jordan. All of them were densely populated seas of makeshift tents filled with families fighting for some sort of life. The Jordanian government was working to bring sanitation, water, and electricity into these impoverished areas, which gradually evolved into urban villages. There were always people like your grandfather and father, Uncle Faisal told me, trying to provide some extra food or money for those worse off. But there were also local drunkards as well as thieves, cheats, and other criminals. It made it hard to raise a family in any normal way. Most of the stories about my family's years in the El Hussein camp came from Uncle Faisal. Until he passed away in 2006, he was like a second father to me, someone who could help me understand my father's silences. He had an almost photographic memory and was near the top of his class in secondary school in Jordan. When he was young, he also wrote poems and stories, including one called Al-Fata Al-Muazzab, The Tormented Child, about a child living in a refugee camp. One of his poems, in which he praised King Hussein, was made into a song and played at a local radio station. I had to write that poem, he said. After all, we could have been in trouble, your dad and me, listening to Cairo radio and insulting the king who had offered us safety. In another time and place, Uncle Faisal could have been a physician or scholar. But my grandfather sat him down one day and said, Faisal, you are one of my most reliable sons. I need you to quit school to work and help the family. Yes, Yaba, I understand. The school principal was terribly upset and came to the house to plead with Tuma to let Uncle Faisal continue his studies. But the family was growing and there were 9 children to feed now. So my uncle began to apprentice as a carpenter. In 1960, when he was 17, Uncle Faisal went to Germany with his brother, my Uncle Saleh, to work in a mine. Contract jobs that paid well. This was a turning point in our family's life. The money they sent home from Germany meant that my grandfather didn't have to work as hard himself and could focus instead on building a new home. There were jokes about Faisal the carpenter helping build the house from a distance. But for my grandfather, it was another step away from memories of that leaky UNRWA tent. When I traveled to Palestine in 2000, I made a trip to Amman to visit my relatives and to recover some of the memories I had of living there with my parents between 1985 and 1988, when I was still young. Originally built on 7 hills, Amman had expanded rapidly during the second half of the 20th century, opening its arms to waves of refugees from Palestine, Kuwait, and Iraq. More recently, they had come from Syria. A lot had happened since I had lived there, and my perspective was different. I wandered through the souks and masjids of Al-Balad, the old downtown area that sits in a valley next to a hill called Jabal Amman. There on the hill, not far from the fancy shops, the cafes, clubs, and restaurants, and the elegant hotels that cluster around the main traffic circle, is the old refugee camp where thousands of Palestinians still live, many in conditions not much better than those in which my father's family lived. One often finds these stark contrasts between rich and poor, and not only in the Middle East. The El Hussein camp is a congested ghetto filled with run-down, ramshackle houses jammed together in narrow, dirty lanes. The houses overflow with families, the roads are crowded, traffic gets snarled, and sometimes sewage runs down open ditches. Approaching Amman by air, you can spot the camp with ease by looking for the countless piles of bricks placed on top of flimsy roofs to prevent them from flying away in a strong wind. In the local markets, tiny neon-lit shops do their business beneath a naked forest of power poles and lines, many of which carry no electricity. Your senses can be overwhelmed by the noise and stench that is occasionally punctuated by the aroma of strong Arabic coffee, honey-laden sweets, and freshly baked flatbread. In 2000, I was about the same age my father was when he was embarking on life as a pharmacy assistant. I'd visited El Hussein several times already, but I had a special errand for which I needed my cousin Muhammad as a guide. Making our way through a maze of lanes, we found the house I was looking for. Muhammad and I knocked on the door, and a young girl, about 8 years old, opened it just a little and peered at us through the crack. She asked us who we were and what it was we wanted. My name is Muafa Said Hausa, I said, and I would like to see the place where my grandparents, uncles, and father once lived. I had brought some groceries with me, which I handed to her. Hesitantly, she accepted the gift. Please, can you wait? She called her mother, who came to the door and asked the same questions her daughter had asked. I answered them again. Ahlan wa sahlan, she said, smiling. Welcome. I stepped inside at the invitation, but my cousin Muhammad hung back. It was obvious that he didn't want to go in. The cramped single-story row house was built out of cement blocks around a small, shared, open courtyard where my father and his brothers had once played, just like I did growing up in Edmonton. But that was the end of the resemblance. It seemed impossible to bridge the gap between their reality and my own. I looked around the tiny house and imagined Grandma Nima calling her husband and children to get ready for supper. My father had told me that they all ate from the same plate and often did not have enough, but that they shared what they had. My eyes burned as I thought of their life here. After 10 minutes or so, I thanked the kind woman with more smiles and left. She would never know how much that visit meant to me or how strongly I felt a connection to my grandparents during that brief glimpse into their lives. Muhammad and I continued to walk through the neighborhood shops and markets, but I noticed that he was unusually quiet. At a shoe store, I looked at some slippers priced at 2 Jordanian dinars, about $3.50 at the time. Afterwards, we stopped for lunch at one of my favorite places, a kebab house called Inta Omri, where I already knew I could get the best kebabs and arrays in Mukayam El Hussein. It was run by a family friend, Muhammad Al Dabash, who'd owned it for more than 40 years. He had known my grandparents and my father. As hard as I tried over the days I was there, I could not get information from him. Today was no different. He kept deflecting my questions. I have come thousands of miles, I persisted. He waved me away. Enjoy it, he urged as he pushed the kebabs, arrays, and grilled vegetables over to me. After Muhammad and I finished our lunch, we took a taxi to an upscale mall in downtown Amman. I could tell he was glad to be out of the refugee camp. Inside the mall, all shining and noisy and new, I wandered into one of the shoe stores. There were Nikes and Adidas and, to my surprise, the same slippers I'd seen earlier. I asked the salesman the price. 10 dinars. Why are they so expensive? My cousin looked agitated. The salesman launched into an explanation of why the slippers deserved such a price. But I wanted to say my piece. Just so you know, I found these same slippers in the El Hussein refugee camp for 2 dinars. Muhammad abruptly walked away. I followed Muhammad outside the mall and into a taxi. He refused to look at me and wanted me to sit in the front of the cab. Although I could guess the answer, I asked him, "What's the matter with you? Why are you so angry?" How could you embarrass us like that, telling him we were at the refugee camp shopping? They might think we'd lived there. They'll talk. He glared at me. I don't care what they think or what you think. It is where my father grew up. He kept quiet, still fuming as the taxi took us through the narrow, congested streets, all the way to his home in a nicer, middle-class neighborhood of the city. When we arrived home, Muhammad stormed inside. His mother asked me what had happened. I told her the story, and she laughed at his reaction. But Muhammad's sister and brother quickly stepped in to defend him, trying to explain how important status is in their culture and how people are judged by where they shop and who they know. Here, people care a lot about our historical roots, you know, they said. And it is true. Everyone we met always asked about our lineage, right up to my great-great-grandparents. Such knowledge doesn't define how people see you, but it does give them a context within which to place you and your family. In other words, if my lineage revealed that my grandparents were collaborating with the Israelis or the English, that label would haunt me for generations. Since almost all Palestinians in Jordan started off living in the refugee camps, and those who made it out of the camps are regarded as successful and affluent, only the poor and miserable remain in the camps. I did not fully appreciate at the time how my actions could affect my family who lived in Amman. The issue isn't Jordanian culture, I retorted. It's your own shame at being associated with the refugee camp. But your father and mother lived there, and some of you were actually born and grew up there. They were furious. As I thought about my response to Muhammad's behavior, I realized that I had been arrogant and insensitive. I had forgotten what I knew about life in a refugee camp, about the way it stains your life. Nothing could be more precarious than that. Maybe one day you will understand it, the kind of place I grew up in, Uncle Faisal once told me, and my father had said similar things over the years. Had Uncle Faisal not helped my family move to Canada, I would have been just like my cousins, living in shame not far from the ghetto of their past, and struggling to hold their heads high. While I visited my family in Jordan and spent time in Palestine, I gradually came to understand that to be Palestinian is to constantly feel displaced, yearning for a place to call home. It is to admit to an identity compromised by loss. 5. Planting saplings. When I was an undergraduate at the University of Alberta, I met a guy named Mustafa. He spoke with a Lebanese accent, and I asked where he was from. I am 100% Lebanese, he replied. He asked me the same question, and I told him I was Palestinian. He looked at me. I don't like Palestinians, he said. It was because of them that Lebanon was destroyed. I had heard this before from Wissam, Aunt Khadija's nephew, on her side of the family. Their family had moved to Canada from Lebanon in 1993, when I was still in high school. You're Palestinian, he said when we first met. I hate Palestinians. His aunt is Uncle Faisal's wife, I thought. We are basically relatives. Years later, I asked his father, who is from the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, why his son would say that. This is ignorance, he replied. The Lebanese people blame the Palestinians for their civil war. Mustafa was not what one would call a model Muslim. He liked to drink beer and flirt. He would tell me stories about late-night parties in Beirut, about his military service, and about his summer job as a tour guide in Lebanon. One day I ran into him while I was walking to class. He looked at me critically and said, "Mwafa, you're a little milazliz." I was taken aback, but not because he had accused me of being overweight, which was what milazliz means. I was surprised that he knew the word at all. I told him that I'd never heard anyone use that word except for a couple of my old-fashioned elderly aunts. "Are you sure you don't have any Palestinian blood in you?" I joked. He was not amused. "Don't be ridiculous," he said. Then he spun around and walked away. A few months later, I found out from Uncle Yazan Haimur that Mustafa's father was Palestinian. His mother was Lebanese, but he had grown up in Jordan, in Amman, in fact. During the summers, he visited his grandparents in Lebanon, where he faced hostility because his father was Palestinian, and that was probably when he had learned to mask his Palestinian roots by adopting a Lebanese accent. It seemed sad that even in Canada he felt compelled to deny his own heritage. Again, the shame, the stigma attached to being Palestinian, coupled with the fear of backlash. In Muslim culture, we are taught that even though another life awaits us after we die, we must never stop doing what is right in this one. In Hadith number 12491, the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, said, "If the resurrection were established upon one of you while he has in his hand a sapling, then let him plant it." We plant one sapling and then another and another, regardless of where we are. Uncle Faisal was the first of our family to leave the Middle East. He ended up in Edmonton in 1964, one of few Palestinians in the city at the time. He was lucky enough to find lodging with a pious Muslim from Lebanon, Mr. Turabian, and his family, who provided him with a home away from home. All the same, Uncle Faisal would get very emotional every time he spoke with his family over the crackling telephone wires. Back in Jordan, Grandma Nima would burst into tears whenever she heard Ba'id Anak, Far From You, sung so powerfully by the famed Egyptian contralto Umm Kulthum. It was not long before Faisal began to wish for a family of his own, and one day he asked Mrs. Turabian if she knew of a good Muslim woman who might be interested in marrying him. Indeed, she did. She had a cousin, Khadija, who lived in Sadnael, a town in the fertile Bekaa Valley in eastern Lebanon. Mrs. Turabian showed Uncle Faisal a picture of her cousin, and my uncle agreed to marry her. Introductions ensued by mail, and soon marriage followed. As Uncle Faisal was unable to leave Canada at that time, he sent a family member over to ask for her hand formally and to participate in the required rituals on his behalf. While the ceremonies unfolded in Lebanon, back in Edmonton, my now newly married Uncle Faisal continued working as a night janitor at the Royal Alexandra Hospital. In 1967, the first Canadian-born Hausa child came into the world, my oldest cousin, Hala. The year also saw the birth of the Canadian Arab Federation, formed to represent the interests of the country's growing Arab-Canadian communities. And, of course, this was the year of Canada's centennial celebration, complete with Expo 67, a world fair with pavilions for many countries and lands, including Kuwait and the United Arab Republic, as Egypt was known at the time. At the end of May, however, Kuwait closed its pavilion. The mood in the Middle East was not festive. Palestinians also remember 1967, but not as a year of celebration. It is impossible to explain succinctly what transpired in 1967, but the end result was disastrous for Palestine. In 1950, Jordan had taken control of the area known as Transjordan, or the West Bank, land that the UN General Assembly had earmarked for an independent Arab state in Resolution 181 on the 22nd of November 1947. Tension had been growing since November 1966, when Israeli troops had marched into the West Bank and attacked the Palestinian village of As-Samoua in retaliation for the death of three Israeli police who had been killed when a border patrol vehicle drove over a landmine reportedly planted by Fatah. More than 100 homes in the village were destroyed, along with a school and a medical clinic. Nearly 20 people died in the attack, including three civilians. Historically, the Sinai Peninsula had been part of Egyptian territory since antiquity. Gaza requires a history of its own. Originally built as an Egyptian fortress in Canaanite territory during the time of the pharaohs, it had a history of being occupied by invading forces. After the First World War, the Gaza Strip, Gaza City, and the surrounding land became part of the British-mandated territory. In 1948, Egypt took over de facto governance of the Gaza Strip until 1967. In May 1967, Egypt, reacting to what it believed was Israeli mobilization along the Syrian border across from the Golan Heights, closed the Straits of Tiran to Israeli shipping, thereby barring Israeli access to the Red Sea via the Gulf of Aqaba. Israel was swift to respond to Nasser's action. On the 5th of June, Israeli planes bombed Egyptian airfields, essentially wiping out the Egyptian Air Force, while ground forces simultaneously launched attacks in the Sinai and the Gaza Strip. After Syria and Jordan entered the fray in support of Egypt, Israel invaded Syria's Golan Heights and seized East Jerusalem and the West Bank. The consequences for Palestine were devastating. When the war ended on the 10th of June, 1967, the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, and large swaths of the West Bank were under Israeli control, and roughly 1 million Palestinians now lived in occupied territory. In the aftermath of the war, entire Palestinian villages in the West Bank were razed, and two refugee camps in the vicinity of Jericho were emptied by forcing the refugees out of their places of refuge. By the end of the year, some 300,000 Palestinians had fled the territories taken by Israel. Palestinians were on the move yet again, their worldly possessions wrapped up in bundles and carried on their heads. Throats parched, they stumbled wearily through the desert, taking shelter in caves where they risked being bitten by snakes and scorpions. From there, they watched the night skies light up with falling bombs. Uprooted families, many for the second time, huddled together in tents as they faced an unknown future, their dreams broken by the rumbling of explosions. The invasion occurred less than 20 years after Al-Nakba, but this new disaster was not a final defeat. The second exodus came to be called Al-Naqsa, the setback. By December 1967 and beyond, hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were fleeing from the West Bank and Gaza to Jordan and Egypt, or from the Golan Heights further into Syria. While Palestinians in the now occupied territories fled their homes, Uncle Faisal and his wife Khadija set up their home in Edmonton, Alberta. A world away, my father and his family continued their struggle to survive in an increasingly crowded refugee camp in Amman. Occasionally, news filtered through about Faisal in Canada, a place many members of my family, including my father, would try to make their new home. So they learned that after working as a janitor, Uncle Faisal had started his own giftware business and was working as a traveling salesman selling oil paintings and other gift items. He was in a better position financially, but it meant that he was away from Edmonton and his growing family for weeks at a time. Uncle Faisal didn't just take care of his family in Canada, but like a good son and observant Muslim, he continued to send money to his family who had been displaced by the Nakba and who needed help. Palestinian exiles, like members of many other diasporic communities, do not forget their relatives living in less fortunate circumstances. Despite the pressures of his job, Uncle Faisal was active in Edmonton's Muslim community in the 1970s and 1980s, by which time the faith community had grown to about 16,000. Uncle Faisal was also a Muslim who said what he meant, often not troubling to soften his words. It had been rough in the refugee camps. "Nothing could be more precarious than that," he told me. "Maybe one day you will know it, the kind of place I grew up in." My father had said similar things over the years, referring to the camp as a kind of cancer on the structure of life that had made him what he was. Often it explained things he saw as flaws or shortcomings in himself. While my uncle settled into his new life in Canada, my grandfather and his family in Amman watched as history repeated itself, not realizing what history was still to come. They thought about Uncle Faisal, now living far away, married and a father, and how he seemed to be finding some financial stability. The loss of the West Bank had dealt a crippling blow to the Jordanian economy, and the city of Amman was increasingly crowded, not only with yet more refugees, but with Palestinian freedom fighters who had shifted their operations from the West Bank into Jordan. They were soon joined by Fedayeen from Syria and Lebanon, and Jordan became the PLO's new home. Groups within the PLO shared a purpose: the liberation of Palestine from Israeli control and the restoration of Palestinian self-rule. Little unity existed, however, as far as tactics went. While many Fedayeen were affiliated with Yasser Arafat's Fatah, many belonged to other more radical groups, the largest and most influential of which was the PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, founded in 1967 by George Habash, who came from my grandfather's village of Lida. During the late 1960s, the Fedayeen became an increasingly bold presence in Jordan, weakening King Hussein's control over the country. Violent clashes were occurring between PLO groups and the Jordanian army, and yet Hussein was reluctant to deal too harshly with the Fedayeen since they enjoyed the support of much of the Arab world. By the summer of 1970, the PFLP was openly calling for the overthrow of King Hussein, as were several other groups. In June, violence erupted at Zarqa, a town not far northeast of Amman, and shortly after that, Fedayeen attacked the Jordanian intelligence headquarters in Amman. As King Hussein was on his way to the scene, Fedayeen opened fire on his motorcade in an assassination attempt that killed one of his guards. Almost immediately, several army units responded by shelling both El Hussein and Al-Waydat, the other Palestinian refugee camp in Amman. My father was working in Kuwait at the time, so he did not experience the chaos that engulfed the refugee camp firsthand, as my grandfather and the rest of the family did. The battle went on for 3 days and left some 300 people dead. Despite negotiations between Arafat and Hussein, no resolution was in sight. At the start of September, fighting broke out in Amman after another attempt was made on Hussein's life. But it was the PFLP's airplane hijackings about a week later, ironically intended to draw fiery attention to the Palestinian cause, that sealed the fate of the PLO in Jordan. In mid-September, the Jordanian army began shelling the two refugee camps again, and this time the battle lasted for 10 days. Even after a ceasefire agreement was signed, the PFLP and another radical group, the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, refused to give up the fight, and as a result, the Fedayeen were driven out of Jordan by the following summer, mostly into Lebanon, which now replaced Jordan as the PLO's new home. My uncles and aunts fled to Aunt Khadija's hometown of Sadnael in Lebanese Baqa Valley with their families and my grandmother. My father and one of my aunts stayed behind in Jordan to protect the new house he had recently built in Jabal al-Nujah from possible looters. He and my aunt described the civil war of 1970 and 1971 as probably the most terrifying period of their lives. Once again, my family was dispersed and had to struggle to make a new home in a foreign land. After the Al-Naqsa, our family dispersed even further than before. Uncle Faisal came to Canada, Uncle Muhammad found work in Iraq, and my father worked in Kuwait. Yet, no matter how busy their lives got or how far they spread across the globe, they kept in touch. As things settled, the family came to a joint decision about their future. For the sake of the whole family, they decided Saeed should come to Canada, along with his brother Muhammad, and that Faisal should sponsor them. Having decided on a course of action, Saeed and Muhammad came to Canada. Once in Canada, my father soon discovered that his credentials as a pharmacy assistant were worthless. Despite his hard-earned diploma and his years of experience, he ended up working in a cement factory. He did not work there for long before he joined Uncle Faisal in his giftware business. By the time Saeed was able to return to Jordan for a visit, his father had died. Saeed had been asked to deliver some gifts to members of his extended family who lived in Syria. Since there were no flights between Amman and Syria, Saeed took a taxi to Damascus. When he arrived at their door, Hanan opened it. It was, he told me, love at first sight. Hanan's parents promised Saeed that they would speak to her about marriage, and he was told to return in a few days for an answer. My father came back bearing many gifts of his own, and he was elated when Hanan's father said, "Ask your family to come and request our daughter's hand." This meant that she had agreed, even though there were more formalities to come. My eldest uncle, Darwish, and several other members of the family then traveled to Syria to ask for my mother's hand in marriage. As per custom, there was the initial meeting to confirm the agreement by sharing coffee and sweets and making arrangements for the marriage. That was followed a few months later by a small wedding ceremony at his uncle Issa's home in Jordan, followed by an Egyptian honeymoon. My parents had originally planned to have a big wedding, but shortly after my mother's family arrived in Jordan, they heard that her brother Majid had been killed in an accident in Syria, which meant that her parents had to return home to make arrangements for the funeral. So instead, the close family gathered at Uncle Issa's house to witness the ceremony. There was no music and no food. Afterwards, they took some pictures and went home. Hanan stayed with her family in Syria while my father returned to Canada to deal with the required paperwork to get my mother to join him. Back in Edmonton, he was so excited and proud that he kept shoving a photograph of his new bride in people's faces, kissing it every few minutes. After Hanan arrived in Canada in 1975, my parents lived for a year with Uncle Faisal's family. From the beginning, my family members attended Edmonton's Al-Rashid Mosque, the first mosque in Canada, which opened its doors in December 1938. It seems strangely appropriate that these displaced souls would find their spiritual home in a mosque that also has its own history of displacement. The original mosque was built by a Ukrainian-Canadian contractor and bore a curious resemblance to an Eastern Orthodox church. It was located right next to Victoria High School, but when the school needed to expand in 1946, the mosque was moved several blocks north to a site near the Royal Alexandra Hospital. By the start of the 1980s, the building had become too small for the city's growing Muslim community, so a new Al-Rashid Mosque was constructed further to the northwest. The old building sat vacant for nearly a decade until plans for the hospital's expansion threatened it with demolition. Thanks to the efforts of the Canadian Council of Muslim Women, it was saved from destruction and funds were raised to move the historic building to Ford Edmonton Park. When I first heard the story of how the mosque was moved, I imagined the mosque being lifted onto a flatbed truck and rolled away by the light of the moon to its new home in the Edmonton River Valley. And there the two mosques are today, one in the north end of the city and one in the river valley beside other historic structures. Displaced and residing in two places at once, much like Palestinians themselves. 6. In the Line of Fire. I was not yet 5 years old in June 1982 when Israel invaded Lebanon with the intention of putting an end to the PLO's presence in the country. Even at that young age, I could feel the effects of what was happening thousands of miles away. I heard my parents and older family members talking, sometimes anxiously, sometimes angrily. My emotional radar could sense how close this new violence was to my parents' hearts. Lebanon had been embroiled in a civil war since before I was born, a war that would drag on throughout the 1980s. The political situation in Lebanon had long been unstable, a Maronite Christian elite arrayed against a Muslim majority, some Shia and some Sunni, with the Muslim population then augmented by an influx of Palestinian refugees from the 1948 war. When, at the start of the 1970s, the PLO shifted its base of operations into Lebanon, its presence further destabilized an already precarious balance of power among rival factions, both political and sectarian. In 1975, fighting erupted, with alliances forming and dissolving as the war unfolded. The Israeli invasion of Lebanon in early June 1982 was accompanied by a new round of heavy bombardment. The attacks lasted for months, provoking international concern that culminated in U.S. intervention. By late August, the PLO had withdrawn to northern Lebanon, and a new president had been installed, Bashir Gemayel, the leader of the Maronite Christian Kataib Party, commonly called the Phalanges in English. Israel refused to withdraw its troops, however, and at the start of September, the government of Menachem Begin rejected a peace plan laid out by U.S. President Ronald Reagan. Instead, and in open defiance of the plan, Israel announced its intention to establish 7 new settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. At Edmonton, the rabbi of Beth Shalom Synagogue responded to these events by inviting the Arab Muslim community to join him in a discussion of the crisis in Lebanon. The rabbi and his wife were acquainted with Uncle Faisal from multicultural events in the city. As the story is told in our family, Uncle Faisal said little at first, but when the rabbi tried to justify Israel's settlement policy as a form of self-defense, my uncle had had enough of the discussion. As he stood up, the scrape of his chair echoed through the hall. "What you say is wrong. Many innocent civilians are going to die because of Israeli aggression. This war should be stopped immediately, and the Israeli government should be persecuted for this massacre." "Massacre?" the rabbi's wife tried to placate my uncle. "Faisal, why are you so angry? You and I share many things. Not eating pork, for instance." "You may not eat pork," he snapped, "but for years you have eaten the flesh off our children's backs." Then he stormed out to the sound of furious clapping. Faisal's prediction proved brutally accurate. Lebanon's new president lasted barely 3 weeks. In mid-September, he and some 24 others were killed when a bomb exploded at the Kataib Party headquarters. Although a member of the Syrian Socialist Nationalist Party was swiftly arrested for planting the bomb, Both the phalangists and the Israelis assumed that Palestinian nationalists were responsible. Retribution was massive and immediate. The Israeli Defense Forces entered West Beirut and surrounded the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps, providing artillery support while phalangist militia attacked. The four-hour assault on Sabra and Shatila was more than a massacre. Women were raped and their bodies mutilated. Children were butchered and thrown onto garbage piles. It was an atrocity enabled by Israeli troops and committed by right-wing Christians, some of whom carved crosses in the flesh of their victims. The number of victims remains a matter of dispute, but the figure of 700 to 800 used by Israel's Commission of Inquiry likely represents about a quarter of the actual total. About a year after the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, E.T., the extraterrestrial creature from the Steven Spielberg film, paid a visit to the Abbotsfield Mall, which was not far from the Beverly neighborhood where my family lived at the time. I remember going with my mother to the mall and excitedly reaching out to touch E.T. His wrinkled body with its skinny neck, huge piercing blue eyes, and long thin hand with the glowing fingertip. At the time, I was oblivious to the irony that one of my earliest memories would be of an alien being who struggled to stay alive long enough to return to his homeland. I also remember a game of tag in our apartment building. I was playing with two brothers, Bashar and Khaldun, who had come with us to see E.T., and several other children, all of us racing up and down the hallways in the building. Bashar was it, and he was chasing me and Khaldun. I was out in front, and at one point I ran through the entrance into another hallway and quickly slammed the door behind me so that Bashar could tag Khaldun, which he did. I started to laugh, and Khaldun, who was furious, came after me. He had a plastic straw in his hand, and the last thing I saw was his hand moving towards my face. Suddenly, the world exploded, and I could not see. My eye hurt like nothing had hurt me before. I was screaming and crying, and someone ran into the apartment building to fetch my parents. My father came to see what had happened. It took him only one look at my eye to assess the damage. He grabbed me, threw me in his truck, and headed for the hospital. He was going so fast that he was stopped by the police. My father pointed at me, and the cops then escorted us to the hospital, lights flashing and sirens whooping to clear the way. At any other time, I would have been thrilled. At the emergency room, the doctor checked my eye, applied some liquid gel, and taped a piece of cotton over it. That night, back home, I snuggled against my mother, terrified that I would lose my eye. "You will be okay. You will be all right," she kept saying to comfort me. "There's nothing to worry about. We are here. You have too much life ahead of you not to see it." But as I lay there, I thought about Uncle Faisal, who had lost an eye when someone threw a stone at him in his youth back in the Middle East. He had lost his eye because of that incident and wore a glass eye for the rest of his life. I felt sad that no one had rushed him to a hospital to save his eye. Only when I was older did I realize that Uncle Faisal saw more with his one eye than most people see with both. Later that year, my father took me to a demonstration against the Israeli bombardment of Lebanon. I sat on my father's shoulders as he marched in downtown Edmonton with hundreds of other community members. There I was, a five-year-old child, happily chanting along with everyone else, "Reagan, Begin, you should know, we support the PLO." Although I really had no idea what was going on, I was beginning to understand that I was Palestinian as well as Canadian. I had a certain kind of blood, but I spoke English and not with the heavy accent of my father. When a local political candidate who was in the crowd asked me where I was from, I said the first words that entered my mind, "I'm Palestinian." He smiled and so did my father. I felt proud of myself. Apparently, I'd said the right thing. I was downtown with my father again in the spring of 1984 when the Edmonton Oilers won the Stanley Cup for the first time. We hollered and cheered every bit as elated as the rest of the crowd. We were part of the whole thing, voices celebrating together, white voices, black voices, brown voices. I knew I was Palestinian, but I was too young to understand racism. I had this innocent idea that people's skin came in different colors, depending on where they were from, that they went to different sorts of churches, and that this was perfectly normal. That fall, I put on sunglasses and a new Edmonton Oilers cap as I left to catch the bus to Glengarry Elementary, which had an Arabic immersion program. My father sold accessories like these at his store, so we had some around the house, and I figured that wearing shades and an Oilers cap would make me look more like the white Canadian kid I desperately wanted to become. But I never got out the door. "Mwafa, where do you think you're going? Come back here now." My mother was always terrified that I would assimilate into Canadian culture and lose awareness of my Palestinian heritage, as if we could ever be allowed to forget that. And she saw every attempt I made to fit in as a deliberate act of rebellion. Her tone when she spoke ripped through me, and I ran. She chased me down the hallway, spanked me, and ripped off the Oilers hat with a strength I'd never seen before. Then she broke the sunglasses into pieces. I walked to school crying, wishing I belonged to some other family. This was the early 1980s, when the idea of an Islamic awakening, or Sahwa, was flourishing throughout the Arab world. My mother became increasingly aware of traditional Muslim values and of building a sense of Islamic community. Among the things she did for the community was to initiate the idea for a preschool at Al-Rashid Mosque. She was elected president of the preschool, an achievement she is very proud of, even if people do not recognize her accomplishment today. Along with many other women in Edmonton's Muslim community, my mother began wearing the hijab to identify herself publicly with our religion. To me, it felt like she and others were hammering away to build a walled compound, trying to keep us safe at all costs. As a kid, I resented this reaffirmation of our Islamic heritage. All it meant was that I would stand out, and not in a way I wanted. At least my father wasn't as adamant about traditional Muslim values. At the time, he was pretty lax when it came to performing religious duties, and he didn't see much reason to import Muslim values into everyday life. Then, in 1985, everything changed. We were at the mosque one evening when my father's close friend, Uncle Yusef, and several other people suddenly came running in. It was Uncle Yusef who broke the news to my father. Someone had broken into the warehouse and had stolen the container truck with his inventory in it. They had taken what they wanted, then set fire to the truck, destroying the remainder of the stock worth hundreds of thousands of dollars in sales revenue. At first, my father was speechless, and then he began to weep. It was the first time I had ever seen him cry. He had started out as a worker in a cement factory when he arrived, then worked as a traveling salesman. It had taken him years to build up his own business, and the whole family was proud of his success. When I visited his store filled with giftware and toys, I felt like it belonged to me, too. My father did not have any insurance coverage, so he lost a significant amount of money in the fire, and he had neither the money to pay back investors nor the will to begin again. For him, losing his business was like losing his sense of purpose. It was like being uprooted yet again. I remember him bursting out in frustration one evening, saying, "Screw this. I'm going home." He handed over what remained of the business to Uncle Adnan and asked him to deal with his creditors while he prepared to move to Jordan. In retrospect, I think my dad needed to escape from what felt like a hostile country to him, a place where he was somehow condemned to failure. He needed the comfort of the familiar. My mother was not enthusiastic about the idea of moving, but she felt it was her duty to follow her husband and support him in times of trouble. For her, moving to the Middle East meant she had to start over again, which caused my mother a great deal of stress about the quality of health care, education, and finances. To compound her hesitation, she worried about being isolated. In Edmonton, she had made friends to whom she could talk to about her marital problems, but she did not have anyone like that in Jordan. Her brothers and sisters lived in Sweden, and she was not close to her Jordanian cousins. Living in Jordan would make her more dependent on my father and his family. As for us children, we were all still too young to understand these complications. All I knew was that we were packing up and moving back to Jordan. For my father, Jordan may have been home, but Amman was foreign to me, a rougher place, noisy and crowded. We had little money left after the loss of the business and the cost of relocation, and we lived in a modest two-bedroom apartment. My siblings and I, all five of us, slept on the floor in one bedroom, while my parents slept in the other room. Even so, my parents found the money to send us to private schools because they valued education. The schools were strict. I remember how, one day, I was hit with a wooden ruler in front of the class for not doing my homework. When my father found out, he was enraged. He came straight to the school and stormed up to the teacher, dragging me with him. "My son is Canadian," he shouted. "Don't ever do that to him again." I felt embarrassed and confused. In Canada, I didn't fit because I was Palestinian. Now in Jordan, I didn't fit because I was Canadian, although apparently this entitled me to privileged treatment. In our final year in Jordan, my father was unable to afford the private school fees, so instead we went to the United Nations Relief and Works Agency school. Once we were back in Jordan, my father managed to start a new business, Mata'am wa Halawiyat Hausa, the Hausa restaurant and bakery in the Jabal al-Nuja neighborhood of Amman, not too far from the El Hussein camp. I could sense that it gave him real satisfaction to be able to provide food for people, even if they were expected to pay for it. He did well for a time, and he insisted on having our apartment furnished in a Canadian way, which was quite unlike the furnishings in the apartments that many of our Middle Eastern neighbors had. The thick carpets and soft leather couches made me feel like I was back in Edmonton. He also installed a hammam frangi, a Western-style toilet, so that we could sit rather than squat. His confidence returned. He was back in Jordan and able to surround his family with comforts that, as a child, he couldn't even imagine in the refugee camp. One day, a young boy passed by my father's restaurant. It was snowing, and he was walking barefoot, wearing only pants and a thin shirt. He made his way along the street, begging for help from those going into and out of the shops. My dad spotted him and shouted into the street, "Where are you who claim to be religious, letting this boy freeze to death?" My father brought him into the restaurant and fed him. He went out, bought him two pairs of shoes, pants, shirts, a jacket, and socks. He also gave him some money before he let the boy go. I sometimes wonder what happened to that boy, who was about my age. For my father, faith was something one lived. He taught me to be suspicious of pious words that were not backed up by actions. Despite its initial success, my father's restaurant ultimately failed as a result of theft and my father's poor financial management. Our deteriorating financial situation put a lot of stress on my parents' relationship. They argued a lot. My father didn't want to return to Canada for fear of being seen as a failure by his Canadian relatives, but my mother put her foot down. He could stay behind if he wanted, she said, but she was leaving, along with the children. She had no money of her own, so she asked her brother Adnan, who had immigrated to Canada shortly before my parents came over and owed my father some money, to buy the airline tickets for her, even though they were not particularly close. I was too young to understand all of what was going on between my parents, but I knew they were angry and unhappy and that returning to the Middle East had not been such a good thing for them, financially, or for their marriage. In the end, they decided that my mother and my siblings would return to Canada, but that I would stay with my dad in Amman while he sold his restaurant and found a buyer for our apartment. Everyone else left, leaving me lonely and forlorn. I missed my mother, and I wanted to be with the rest of the family, not stuck in Amman, with only my father for company. A few months later, I was sent back to Canada with my uncles Saleh and Riyadh, while my father waited for the money from the sale of the apartment. Because Uncle Saleh couldn't speak English, I was told to act as his interpreter. During my time in Jordan, I had forgotten a lot of my English, and on the flight home, I mistakenly told Uncle Saleh to put salt in his coffee because I couldn't read the label on the container and guessed the word. An already stressful trip instantly became worse. According to my passport, we landed in New York on September 11, 1988. During our stopover, I struggled to remember how to order a cheeseburger. I was terrified that I would end up with the wrong thing. When we finally arrived in Edmonton, my mother hugged me for a long time. She was as relieved as I was that we were together again. She and my brothers and sisters were renting a 3-bedroom townhouse in northwest Edmonton in an area called Castle Downs. I'd been back for 2 months before my father returned and rejoined Uncle Faisal at the giftware business. I don't remember him talking much about Jordan after that. It was as if the whole thing had never happened, but the fault lines that had appeared in my parents' relationship in Jordan remained. It did not help that they both avoided any conversation about their situation. Living on her own had also changed my mother, and that compounded the situation even more. We stayed in the Castle Downs house for about a year until my father was able to purchase a house for us to live in. Even so, it was difficult for my father to reestablish himself financially in Canada. I had completed grades 3, 4, and 5 in Jordan, so in the fall of the year we returned to Canada, I entered grade 6 at Lorelei Elementary School. It was a strange experience because although I quickly regained my understanding of English, I was afraid people would laugh at me if I spoke the language. As a result of my hesitancy to speak English, I was put in an ESL class, but it felt weird to be relearning a language I had spoken fluently before our sojourn to Jordan. However, I was very motivated to relearn English and picked it up again in no time at all.